Hi, this is Father Jim Martin. I'm a contributing editor at America Magazine, and this is one of our America Magazine podcasts. I am sitting in for Tim Reedy, our online editor, because we are interviewing today Robert Sullivan, who has just written a book called My American Revolution. And I've actually just finished the book. And I'm somewhat obsessed with the book. I think that's not too strong a word. It's a wonderful book. I found it thoroughly fascinating, and I'm really happy to greet and welcome Robert Sullivan to America Magazine.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Listen, I just love this book. For people who you know, might not be familiar with it yet, can you give us like a little thumbnail sketch of what's going on?
Thumbnail sketch would be, and I should say, huzzah to your obsession. Thank you very much. Oh boy. And I'm worried about you now. But the thumbnail sketch would be...
A healthy obsession.
Hopefully. The thumbnail sketch would be that most Americans, if you stopped an American on the interstate highway and asked them how the revolution went, they'd say, you know, there was a lot of stuff up there in Boston, and it might have ended in Virginia. It was definitely run by Virginians, and it happened in Boston. And there were the Minutemen, and there was a lot of stuff in Boston. And the kind of... argument's too strong a word, because if you argue with me, you get to win. But the sort of idea is that in the New York City horizon, in the tri-state area, in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, some of Pennsylvania, that's where the war happened. Mm-hmm. The majority of battles happened here. And you know, if you stand on top of the Empire State Building and you kind of look around you, that is where the war was not so much won, but not lost. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing that is a big thing about this book. It's kind of about learning from losing.
So. Yeah, and that's one of the first scenes of the book. You atop the Empire State Building and kind of gazing out at things and kind of pointing out to people, you know, where things happened. Why do you think, I was very curious reading the book. I mean, I'm from Philadelphia, and so I delighted in your one of the first chapters that talks about the reenactment of Washington crossing the Delaware. So I know little of that. And my sister lives in northern New Jersey, where a lot of the book is focused. Why do you think, though, I mean, this might come as a surprise to a lot of people. Why has New Jersey, you know, in a sense, been kind of sort of given second-class citizenship among the 13 colonies? It is kind of surprising, particularly when you think about, we can talk about this later, Morristown and all the battles there. What happened in New Jersey that they didn't kind of, you know, glom onto this like Boston and Philly did?
I mean, it's hitting me at this moment as to how far back maligning Jersey goes.
Yeah.
And I've got a lot of things are flowing, you know, running into my head. But I mean, I remember Lincoln... I remember as a kid reading that Lincoln would say when he came through New Jersey, and surely he was trying to win votes. Maybe it was a swing state there.
Right. Electoral college, right.
Who knows? But he would say that, you know, I know from being a kid and reading the stories of the war, the revolution, that it all happened here, that all the battles were in New Jersey. And, you know, I guess one of the big reasons is that, you know, there were mostly losses there. Most of the battles were skirmishes. And, you know, in the Meadowlands in New Jersey, which
right.
is known for, you know, mob hits and toxicity mm-hmm. and pollution.
Sports arenas and...
All that stuff. In the Meadowlands, that's considered, you know, a despoiled landscape, and it's kind of a joke, Secaucus. Mm-hmm. Johnny Carson used to say the word Secaucus in the mm-hmm. 60s, and people would be in mm-hmm. hysterics. So, because there were pig farms. So, I mean, I think the landscape somehow... can't be considered noble.
Yeah.
The idea that somehow Jersey is where America starts and this is our opinion of Jersey, mm-hmm. I think it's still hard for people, very hard.
Well, and was one of the goals of this book to kind of restore this geography into people's psyche?
I think the goals of pretty much all my books are to... that's pretty much the goal of all my books. So actually the first book I wrote was about the Meadowlands.
Mm-hmm.
And... you know, I started with this poem. It's actually kind of my theme poem. It's God's Grandeur is the poem.
Oh, sure, yeah,
and,
Hopkins.
You know,
nice Jesuit poet.
All the earth is trod, and you know, it's all beat up, and yet somehow, you know, like shook foil, it's still shining, and so this idea that a beat up landscape is never gone. And in a way, it's kind of like the second class citizen landscape. Mm. And so this story is about how all the stuff that we don't think of as big and important and worthy of an HBO, you know, week-long or month-long documentary or month-long biopic, this is about how all these places were key in the smallest possible ways, you know, many, many keys.
Yeah, and in many, and in some big ways too.
I mean, huge. I mean, the evacuation, there's a great evacuation in New York City in the Battle of Brooklyn. We lose right away. We lose. Our first battle after the Declaration of Independence. You know, we try to face off against the British. It's an island city, kind of a bad idea. The biggest naval fleet in the world. We lose. And then the whole army is evacuated by a bunch of fishermen from Massachusetts. The whole army is evacuated from Brooklyn to Manhattan overnight. The British were marveling about it for decades. Mm. How did they do that? And it was about, I would argue it's about looking at the tides and really the most mundane and banal things and how understanding the landscape was so important.
Speaking of the landscape, I found it also a very spiritual book, and I want to tell you a story that we didn't talk about before you came in, just to see how you'd react to it and whether or not this resonates with you. It's a story from my own life. I'll keep it short because this is about your book, not my book. I grew up outside of Philadelphia, and right down the street from my house in the suburbs was a Quaker meeting house that was from the late 1600s or early 1700s. So it really predated Washington. Washington's horses slept there, as you know they did in most places,
sure,
in Philadelphia.
Places.
And I would walk past it every day on the way to high school. And it's very beautiful, and it was kind of the center of our town. But I never went in once, right? Never was interested. Played in the graveyard. No clue about what was there. And after I entered the Jesuits, about a year or two after, this friend of mine who was a Quaker, a member of the Society of Friends, invited me to a Quaker meeting there. So I go in. Now my sort of spiritual consciousness is kind of awakened and a little more interested in those kinds of things. I go into this place. It's beautiful. I mean, it's this beautiful, simple, austere, ancient place of prayer, and we stayed there for a meeting and prayed. And what I thought about that when I was reading your book, because what I thought was, in my backyard, you know, is this not only historical place, but this kind of beautiful place, you know, kind of underneath and, you know, everybody's consciousness. And I thought about that a lot when you were kind of walking through these places, particularly, and this is one of the best parts of the book, your way of walking through the modern landscape and kind of recalling, you know, what's kind of buried beneath. So that's sort of what that for me was the sort of emotion I had through the whole book. And in that way, it was very poignant, you know, because it's a sense of what we all have in our own backyards, basically.
That's a better story than the reader probably will get.
Well, you can put it in your next
book.
But
it should be in the next, if there is a next edition. That's exactly it. It's always how you approach a place, you know, and so you walk through a place every day with this mindset. And so how can you look at anything fresh? This is a huge thing for us in every aspect of our lives. Mm-hmm. How can I look at a place and understand its former importance? And then I think the strategy of a landscape is almost built in. You know, we're defined by where we are, where we work, and we make those places too. So there's mm-hmm. this back and forth. And so to look at, you know, to look at the kind of, you know, roads or places that were used in colonial times, and then realize, oh my gosh, the King's Highway.
Yeah, that was fascinating.
Is still, it's like a city is almost a better place where to find the old path, and to say, oh look, it still matters, and it's still,
and it still named these things, and it still has these
still
kind of resonances.
Everything's still there, and then what are the resonances? It's kind of to kind of look through those. But I mean that's exactly, in a way, this book is. You know, what are you supposed to do when you're a writer? You try to write something, and I'm trying to get people's brains fired up, I guess. Yeah. You know, their brains are probably better than mine, so they'll fire higher. How do you do that? So in a way, it's sort of like an art project. If you follow me for a second, watch this. But then, what does that do for you? So it's a lot of that. But the start with the panorama, I'm actually thinking from the top of the Empire State Building about, believe it or not, Achilles' shield. Mm. And in the shield are all the battles. So it's a piece of art about the past. And sort of art is a way we negotiate with the past. But the other big Virgil project I'm thinking of is the Georgics, which is, you know, George Washington, King George, earth worker, farmer maybe. But this idea of the Georgics being a farm calendar and scholars killing themselves and saying it must mean something more than just describing what it's like on a spring morning or in a fall evening. And yet, why does it have to be more is my question. And so I'm trying to kind of get people to cross a river, go through some mountains, right, and then time is gone. Yeah. If you know you pay the $26, there's no more time, and then you're in all time. So not only are you noticing the Quaker meeting house for the first time and saying, oh my gosh, I never realized what that was, but at the same way, when you become, and I'm about to hit the half century mark this year, it'll be 50, after you see a winter storm 50 times, you start to recognize that that's what they're talking about in 1776 / 1932 / you know, that it all lines up in the calendar, in the boring almanac.
Yeah, and it's the same. I mean, that's for the people who haven't read it, that's one of the great scenes of the book, kind of realizing that this kind of storm, you know, that you were experiencing and sort of going back and saying, yes, this would have affected things. We tend to, as you say in the book, not look at the weather, you know, not look at those kinds of things. You know, when it comes to big battles like that or major shifts in history, but that's very important. I want to ask you one question. How were you able to, or how did you choose among all the different historical events? Because I would say that, you know, you have the reenactment of Washington crossing the Delaware, which happens in Philadelphia. You have, you know, the battles in Brooklyn. And there's a lot you could have picked from. I mean, there was so much going on, that the battles in Morristown, those kinds of things. Was it hard to kind of sort out what you wanted to focus on and what you could have, what was less important to you?
Well, I was actually thinking, you know, I was looking at that kind of map, and I have my kind of, you know, radius of New York map. I was looking at all the battles in the area, and then I was trying to pick the kind of key, the ones that I thought people know about, and the ones that I thought people don't know about. So crossing the Delaware is kind of a big thing.
Right.
People talk about the crossing of the Delaware. So to do a history of that reenactment, so I'm not writing history of the crossing of the Delaware, no. I'm writing a history of that reenactment.
And for people that don't know, it's a reenactment that happens every year.
Every year.
Around Philadelphia.
Christmas.
Right, Christmas.
Everybody
is it Christmas Day?
Dresses
right?
up.
Yeah.
Christmas Day.
Right.
And it's been going since 1950. Yeah. Now I'm forgetting four, I think. And yes, Grace Kelly's brother,
Jack
Kelly, right, did it for years. And it was started by an actor / producer / impresario, also his you know, amateur historian. But then what did it become? Now it used to be a couple of guys in a boat, kind of, you know, there's sort of fun. And now it's fun, but it's a very regimented thing. It's become something else. And it's actually, I found it to be actually more beautiful than I thought it would be, because at the very end I noticed somebody threw a wreath out in the river, and it was for an old reenactor who had recently passed away, and it was really quite beautiful. But anyway, so I thought about key things, and then importantly, not key things, if that makes
because
sense.
They weren't excavated as much in
because they
literature.
Were because people felt they didn't matter as much.
Yeah,
yeah, like there's a regiment that was buried in Brooklyn.
Yeah,
that
that's nobody, fascinating.
And also there's the bones of the war dead, of the prisoners in Brooklyn, which is amazing. But I also thought about these kind of the features of a landscape, a river, mountains, the sky, the water. Those are the big themes I was going for. And this idea that water in itself, a river is, you know, literally the Delaware is yesterday's Catskill rain and tomorrow's ocean. Mm-hmm. You know, so it captures everything in it. I mean, it literally is that, which is kind of amazing. And then, you know, I always think about how the Psalms, for instance, I mean, all spiritual readings have these valleys that look so good to us. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, there's kind of spiritual nourishment in reaching the top of a hill. And so I'm kind of trying to play with these themes and see where the brain will go with those.
Yeah, the word's used too frequently, but it is a very spiritual book. It's a pilgrimage of a sort.
I mean, you know? I feel as if, you know, that, I mean, I was thinking a lot about, you know, the past and fathers and frankly death and what that means. And then I had to kind of come up with one reenactment of my own, that I would actually, rather than recount reenactments mm-hmm. or describe them, I went for my one signal. I made this one reenactment.
Do you want to describe that? Because it's pretty powerful.
So surely now people will say, that's it? That's all? It's just, what, are you kidding me? And really, it is really, really simple. I took a... I used a Boy Scout signaling mirror, which is about, you know, as big as a deck of cards. But what I did was the Watchung Mountains, mm-hmm. which you know, and you're one of four or five Americans who know.
Can you describe where they are for listeners?
The Watchungs are, so if you're looking at a map of the New York area, if you go left of Times Square, and first you cross over the river, and then you cross over this kind of bump of hills, and you cross the New Jersey Meadowlands, which is like a big, you know, almost empty glacial lake. And then you hit this kind of horseshoe-shaped chunk of mountains, which you can see on old colonial maps. Mm-hmm. I read a geologist's paper who looked at all the wars that ever happened in North America, and he said this was the key to George Washington's entire military strategy. Mm-hmm. After being beat in New York and crossing the Delaware, he was hid in these mountains, and he could jump in and jump out and not get beat. Mm-hmm. To win the war, he would not lose the war. And it was all about the Watchung Mountains. And he returned there several times. And no offense to Valley Forge, things were tough there. But there was a worse winter in Morristown, New Jersey, which is in the Watchungs.
Which, by the way, is now sort of a mix of middle class and very wealthy suburbs. It's a kind of incongruous place for this to happen if people go there now.
You wouldn't think that. But there are also places in the mountains where there are old woods in the mm-hmm. mountains, and it's really beautiful. When you climb up to the top of the Watchungs, you look back at the city, you look at the whole entire estuary, the harbor, you can see to Connecticut and you know, in towards Pennsylvania. And it's like being in the bleacher seats of the land of the Wizard of Oz. You know, it's beautiful, and it's so dramatic. And you know, all the streets in each town along the way are Prospect Street, and you know, what is a prospect? You know, to make a short story, you know, miserably long. Basically, I found out that George Washington, when I was hiking, sort of 3-day hike, 30 miles from Princeton to Morristown, the second night, I camped in a friend's backyard. A poet's backyard, always a good thing to do. The second night, I camped in a hotel, and the young guy working at the desk, I thought he was going to kick me out because camping stuff in the hotel. But no, he said, you're doing the George Washington. You got to go up to the top of the Watchung Mountain right there, because that's where George Washington went, and he signaled back.
Now, I was surprised to read that in this book. This is a guy in the hotel?
This is a guy, young guy. Yeah. I was so inspired. I'm so, America's going to be okay, is basically how I felt.
Yeah.
Also, I was sore, because it was a really long trip, and I had back problems. Okay, so then, so it turns out that at many points along the Watchung Mountains, this is, you know, this is going quite a few miles, maybe 30 miles long, the chain, or 20 miles. All along, there are points that tradition says, or in fact, he did. Washington or the troops got up and they built fires. They built, and there's drawings of them, these sort of large pyramid type things that were filled with kindling wood. And if there was troop movement by the British who controlled New York City, they would light this fire and the militias would know that something was happening. So imagine seeing...
A la Lord of the Rings.
A la Lord of the Rings, exactly. Right. Imagine seeing that long chain mm-hmm. of fires, and Tolkien could do a much better job of this than me, of course. So that long chain of fires... So I said, this is what I'm going to do. This is my reenactment. I am going to signal back to New York. So I'm going to climb up one of these points. I would go up to the mountains on a Saturday, and my wife would be down in Brooklyn and on the water, and she'd look, and she wouldn't see it. She'd bring a friend. They'd look. They wouldn't see it. I'm like, come on, I'm signaling. Why can't you see me? And so then I keep doing this. And in the meantime, as I'm exploring this, I find that not only does each site become in the 1950s, the army sets up posts, guns to shoot Soviet bombers mm-hmm. all along the Watchung Mountains, at almost to a dot where Washington had his, or tradition says he had his signal points. Not only is that the case, but it's also the case that almost every single one of these spots that I'll signal from has a 9/11 memorial, because when the towers burned, people mm-hmm. went to these spots to look back at the city, and then subsequently set up memorials for the people that from their town that had died in the city.
And so you find out that a lot of these legendary things are actually make sense.
They
right?
all make sense, and everything aligns. Mm-hmm. The strategy of that place still matters to us. And this is the amazing thing, that we return to places over and over. Why? Why do we? Well, so Anyway, the story's ending, and it is, I tried my landlord on the roof of our building in downtown Brooklyn. That didn't work, and then he had to go help his wife do something.
No,
and
for people who don't know, this is the opposite side, people sort of receiving your
light.
Yeah,
they're trying to, I'm hoping that people in New York will see me from the mountaintop 18 miles away, exactly 18 miles away, and I'm using a small handheld mirror. Oh, because first I thought I'd do a fire, but then I'd be arrested. I don't want to get arrested. And then I looked at, you know, really expensive lights, but then you had to have a car and a battery, and that was... So then I got to the mirrors. I'll just use a mirror. And in the morning, I could get it up till about 11 o'clock. I could signal back. Finally, I've got my daughter, and for many weekends, we failed. And now I have to hurry because the leaves are coming out. So I have to beat. And that's the joke here. It's not about the American Revolution so much as the revolution of the sun, the season. I have to beat the leaves coming out. So finally, I can't get her to see me. Finally, I reverse the process, and I go to her school with her. And at the end of the day, we see the Watchung Mountains in the distance. I said, where could I go that you would see me? And she points to a place. And then I got to that place, took a train, I hiked up over a reservoir. I had thoughts that I was going to be like a security problem for somebody, and I wasn't. It was up in a public park. And I found the ridge, and I called her school. I thought she had a free period. She didn't, but they let her out anyway. She went to the music room, and I started signaling, and all of a sudden I just heard screaming on the phone and the whole classroom, and oh my God, what if I had failed? And she told me, I had failed every time up to that. I failed in front of her friends. I'm a bad leader. I'm a bad commander. I blew it there. I'm sorry. But anyway, I signaled, and they were screaming, and they could see it. And the great thing is I couldn't see it. It's just me and the quiet of the hill and signaling.
It's beautiful. Yeah, that was my favorite scene in the book, and was so unexpected. And there's a sense of, as I read it, there was a sense of connection, too, between the generations over distances. There was a sense of kind of poignancy of thinking of Washington and his troops sort of feeling lonely as well, which I got from that. And I found that really touching, funny, exciting, and let me tell you, perfect coda to the book.
Well, thank you. Yeah. That's what I was going for. I really like the idea that you don't know what you're saying into the future, and you're just a dot in the panorama, but you're all together something, you know.
Well, it's also, frankly, you know, when you were talking, I was thinking of the Gospels and just sort of preaching the word. I mean, you cast it out there, and you don't know how people are going to respond to it, or how they're going to accept it, or how many are going to respond to it. And the idea that you're there with your tiny little, I mean, it's a great image, you with your little Boy Scout mirror, and a classroom full of students bursting into cheers is just
is Jesuitical a word?
It is,
but there's this idea, this kind of Karl Rahner has this idea that also kind of a theme that I'm always trying to work around, and it's the idea that you are an expression of your community. I mean, so your community makes you. Mm-hmm. And there's that idea that in the panorama, you see yourself. Mm-hmm. I think these two things are really, really connected. Mariners will tell you that if the light conditions are right, because of refraction and all the things I can't explain to you, you can see a ship when it's gone past the horizon. Or, oppositely, mm-hmm. you can see a ship before it's come to you. So that idea of like a veil between the worlds, and is there separation? And when I camped in the backyard of the poet, is another Irish poet. So this idea of all these things that are in Celtic mythology, the worlds, are they separate? The past, the present. So I think that physical fact of the mariner, that the mariner knows that you can see beyond the horizon. I find that to be tremendously, I'll say it, spiritual. Sorry.
That's a great place to end. I want to, I don't know if one does this on podcasts, but I really want to recommend this book. What I'd like to say also is it is not just for people who live in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Pennsylvania.
This is what I don't want.
Yeah, of course.
I don't want to say that New York's any better than any place. What I'm trying to say that is that every place has value.
Right.
And I'm sure a New Yorker, I was born in this island, Manhattan, will say, oh, look, New York's the best place. No.
Right. And then you can do this kind of excavation or exploration of a landscape and a life, and history anywhere. But I think this book, it's well written. It's interesting historically because you'll find out things that you never knew about, the American Revolution, which I think is kind of, I find the American Revolution kind of inherently interesting for people. What it's one of the first things we learn when we're young. Interestingly, it sort of happens at the beginning of the school year, so you're very fresh. So I think people are just naturally kind of attracted to the story, you know, constitutionally, to make a pun. But it's also, you know, it's a story about, you know, a personal quest. It ties in things about the weather. It's funny. It draws you along. So I just want to say thanks for the book. Thanks for a great reading experience. Thanks for teaching me a lot about the area in which I live. And thanks for coming in and talking to our listeners at America Magazine today.
I mean, thank you more.
Great. So this is Jim Martin, contributing editor. I've been speaking with Robert Sullivan, author of the book My American Revolution, Crossing the Delaware and I-78. Thank you.